All right, and welcome to the OatHealth.com Heart Health Podcast. I'm your host, Matt, and I'm joined by Joe. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning.
And thanks for joining us for episode number two, May 12, 2009. A reminder for every one of our shows, all the research and support material for today's episode and all our shows are available at www.oathealth.com/blog/podcast. Today's episode, we're going to cover one of the main topics, which is why asking how much food is in your food is a crucial step in improving your heart health.
Yeah, I think that, you know, we're going to start exploring more of the decision-making process. I think we want to get into more of why do we choose choice A or choice B. And just, we're starting to see that the eat more fruits and vegetables or else kind of message is not really kind of getting us to our health goals. So I think some of this decision-making process discussion will really help our listeners.
Perfect. So, and then in our research, we're going to review a May 11 article found in the Center for Science and Public Interest called Heart Health, Heart Attack Entrees with a Side Order of Stroke.
Yeah, so we don't usually like to use the, this is not a tactic we're going to subscribe to here at this podcast of using the fantastic news articles, but I think this one really actually has some good stuff in it, and it's real. It really is. I mean, as far as like what they're going to talk about, it's real life. It's not like they're just making stuff up.
So right. So in there, it's an important discussion about how super salty restaurant meals present long-term health risks for all of us and immediate danger for a few of us. And then in the news, we're going to break down an article found on Medscape from WebMD, how new onset diabetes in older adults largely attributable for lifestyle.
Yeah, so once again, what we do on a daily basis really affecting our health long term.
Okay, and so they outline in there four lifestyle habits that contributed to 80% of new diabetes cases. So I think we want to look at that. And let's jump into today's podcast. Okay, and we're back to episode number two, and I want to jump into recent news. What is this all about, this heart attack entrees with the side order of stroke that you found this article?
Yeah, so if you're not familiar with the Center for Science and Public Health or Public Interest, they have some really neat stuff every once in a while, and they kind of highlight the real, like, out there, like, saturated
fat.
Are
they normally kind of dramatic this way with...
No, you know what? They have a lot of good... They have a really solid newsletter, but this on the back page, there's sometimes like the best and worst. Kind of like the worst is like this big, huge, like just recently it was like a 1,800 calorie like milkshake.
1,800 calorie milkshake. So it's like a little bit fun,
yeah,
but also serious.
I mean, yeah. I mean, so that's real. I mean, when it hits you, it's like, huh, that's, I can't believe somebody would make that. But you probably ate something similar to that in the last week or so. You know,
so it's not their really newsletter has off. Like the best and worst.
Yeah, and so like there's a heart healthy pancake, I think was the last one too. I was looking at with this one. So yeah, I mean, so they're kind of in this one, they're gonna highlight and bring together some of these like really out there as far as salt content of foods. So, I mean, let's just even look. I mean, they, and one of their big taglines is we name names. So I guess we have to name names here as well. So, let's just break down some of these meals. Red lobster, chicken fingers, biscuit, fries, raspberry lemonade, 2,430 milligrams of salt. Yeah. And so Chili's country fried chicken crispers with rice and 1% milk. 2,385 milligrams of salt. Wait, hold up. You know what? I'm reading the children's portions amount of salts. So, I mean, this is like, I guess one of the things that really shocked me was that's a day's amount for an adult.
What was the milligrams again?
So the first one was 2,400, just over 2,400. The next one was just under 2,400.
And how much should an adult get per day?
Right around 2,400. You know, like probably not more than 2,400. Depends on the source. You look at 23, 24. They're saying actually 23 here, but I've seen 24 as well. But so I mean, that for me was like, that was the shocker for me. It's like, oh my gosh, you know, like that's the kid's meal. And that doesn't sound, you know, your kid's going to eat the whole portion there. It's not like they're like choosing like super appetizers and like adding in, you know, desserts, and this is just the meal. So I mean, if you add to it a dessert or maybe an appetizer that they're eating a little bit of, I mean, that's gonna
right
add
away
as well.
I hear this and I think You know, first of all, I don't order that. Second of all, I don't always eat all of the portion, you know, at the restaurant. Third of all, I, you know, justify it further. Right. Like, well, I don't normally order
what
dessert.
What other things that I justify it with?
Yeah, right. But I think what we're highlighting here, right, is, or what the article is highlighting, is it's surprising sometimes the areas that you can find high salt content that you're not thinking about.
Well, and it's really, the numbers are just overwhelming. So, I mean, so, you know, as a kid, they're saying, you know, like, you shouldn't get more than 1,200 milligrams of sodium a day. Mm-hmm. Does that mean you don't eat any more salt the rest of that day, or earlier that day, or the next day? I mean, right. So no salt in the next 2 days.
To compensate, you know, for the setting.
Yeah, and so so for young kids, maybe not as big of an issue. It still is. Let's not just call it, well, it's not that big of an issue. But it really can be. But really, this really plays into a little bit more with older adults. And so let's kind of break down some of these too. Once again, our friends Red Lobster top the list here. Admiral's Feast with Caesar salad. Caesar salad's good, yeah. Right? Creamy lobster topped with mashed potatoes, cheddar bay biscuit, which they're pretty good. I've had one. And a lemonade. 7,100 milligrams of sodium. So, I mean, that's just
compared
kind of...
Compared to 2,400 you're supposed to have.
Yeah, so that's overwhelming. I mean, I don't even know how to, like, even begin to break that number down. I don't think we need to even break that number down.
Right,
I don't
but
think
it's more really than twice to... your daily recommended limit.
Yeah, in one meal. And one of the concerns this article really brings up is just the fact that for some people, that can be a huge issue. I mean, if you already have cardiovascular disease... You're getting up there in age, you know, a hit of sodium like that could really cause some serious issues.
So, I mean, if you're not thinking it through, and I think a lot of people who are suffering from one issue or another, you know, they're going to be conscious of this. But if you're not thinking about, these are extreme cases, but if you're not thinking about it, you may the next day or so be feeling a little off if that's something you're supposed to be watching. And so really we're just highlighting, hey, when you walk into a restaurant, you do need to be conscious about what's in each serving, right?
Yeah, and that's what I think. I think this can just give us some general rules and guidance. So especially, I mean, if I'm eating out every night, because this really covers, you know, Red Lobster's on the list here, Chili's on the list here, Olive Garden. And I'm not even saying that these are the bad places to eat, but you can kind of see that they really cover a large gamut of places you might eat at.
Those are representative of... Yeah. Just about every place you could go.
Yeah, I think across the board. And, you know, a nice sit-down meal at Olive Garden, and we're looking at, you know, just over 6,000 milligrams for one of the meals here, just under 6,000 for another one. You know, so it just to lean on that as a source of food for maybe even more than one meal a day can really add up.
So this is a great article. It's something to think about. You know, be active in what you're choosing and know what's in it as much as possible. So moving on to the research section of our show, Joe, you found I think, again, we don't try to be dramatic, but sometimes these things are. And so I was just really taken aback. It's this article found on Medscape WebMD said that 80% of new cases of diabetes in a group in their study,
right,
is highlighting, right, that four lifestyle attributes contributed to this? New cases.
Yeah, so new cases. So this is, once again, we're going to try to break these down a little bit. We're not going to get too sciencey, but we want you to understand some of this. So prospective cohort study. Mm-hmm. Prospective meaning that they start here and they look forward, and they set
not
the parameters ahead of them.
Looking forward.
And then there's a certain group. And so this group is 65 years and older, mm-hmm. You know, men and women together. And so the cohort just meaning the group. And this is a good, once again, as far as weightiness, this is a good type of study. It's a solid study. It's not the gold standard. It's not the randomized control.
Cohort
as a type of study is a good solid study. So that's good. And in the amount of number of people, 4,800. People involved, that's good. That's a good solid number as well. Mm-hmm. So this is a bigger study. It does carry a little more weight to it.
And the time frame on this, was it 10 years?
They followed people for 10 years. Yeah. So
it's pretty significant.
Yeah. So, and it was published in the Archives of Internal Medicine, and they looked at a number of different factors that are contributing to the onset, mm-hmm. a new onset, which would be like, I just found out I had diabetes within that 10-year period. And then following what contributed to that. And these four factors you had kind of highlighted at the beginning there, you know, looking at physical activity.
Okay.
Dietary habits, healthy dietary habits, smoking cessation, so stopping smoking, and light or moderate alcohol use, so, you know, kind of keeping that in a moderate range.
So just back to one, just so I'm clear on it, smoking cessation means I was smoking and I stopped?
You know, I'm not 100% sure, but I think that it may have both. It may have both tied there, you know, stopping and also just not smoking at all.
Okay. So that may contribute. You know, either way, these four factors really kind of sound similar to some of the other studies we've done that weren't about diabetes, but heart health.
Well, the funniest thing is I found this morning. I really was just kind of like, well, we're getting ready for this. I already have some things lined up, but Let me take a look at what's out there. And yeah, this one, not the gravity of think of the one we looked at last week, which was 30,000 people,
mm-hmm.
and it was a case control as opposed to cohort. It's not as good of a design in some ways, but still the 30,000, 52 countries, every inhabitable continent. You know, it's hard to get away from. 90% of the risk of first-time heart attack found in those nine modifiable risk factors. So the same kind of thing here. Four modifiable risk factors, so four things we can control,
right.
Contributing to 80% of in just this study. So once again, we want to take this is not a review of studies, this is one study, but I think it carries a lot of weight, and it, for me, once again, pretty exciting to kind of see this really come out in a study that really can give us some substance that we can take something away from. And then actually 80%, big number, you know, that once again, it kind of, it means you, it means me, yeah. It means the people around, you know. So actually we add to that obesity, which once again that's modifiable.
Mm-hmm.
We can contribute to that. You add in obesity and that number jumps up to 89%.
Right, so out of 10 new cases of diabetes in this study out of the 4,800 people were attributed to four things: physical activity, healthy dietary habits, smoking cessation, light or moderate alcohol use, and then that jumps to almost 9 out of 10 when you include being overweight or obesity, right? And
yeah.
But I would assume that normally age and genetics are still pretty heavy contributors to diabetes.
I think what they're looking at here was saying, okay, you know, age is going to play a big part here. And for some people, as we get older, we just assume we're going to have some of these things. So I think they were actually approaching this to the extent of saying, okay, as we get older, how much can we contribute to our the occurrence of diabetes? And I think that, you know, age happens to all of us. Genetics happens to all of us. But this is something where I think it's showing we can happen to it. You know, we can actually make an effect on health, and we can actually have a part to play. And that's a lot of what's driving, I think, of, you know, what we did in the last podcast, what we're going to do in the next few podcasts is, you know, it's not only enough to know maybe what to do, and I think that's still a missing component, but I think it's really this active role that we want to be able to play. And how do we think through the process? What's really contributing to our thought process? So,
you know, it just occurs to me, Joe, that whatever factors we're talking about, you know, physical activity, dietary changes, that I think what we're trying to do is encourage people to encourage better health. And so we talk about, well, there's these four factors, and it's really compelling to hear it in research, but hopefully what you're hearing from these sharing the research and just going over and over again is you can encourage better health, or I don't want to say preventing certain diseases, because like we always acknowledge that genetics are a part of it,
right.
But there's this overwhelming study to say that you can encourage better health. And it comes down to decisions, right? Basically being active every day and saying, how can I encourage better health today? And actually, this, I guess, leads us right into one of our main topics about just making better food choices. And you always say, and I think it's our theme, that you should ask yourself how much food is in your food. And I think this really translates today.
Right, yeah. So last week we talked more about like theories of disease and maybe got a little more heady. But I think just looking at that and saying, okay, the lifestyle theory where we're kind of sitting up more, we're gonna skew more that way, is saying that I have a choice to make. I have it. I have some things that I can affect that really can really affect long-term disease.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a lot of what we looked at. And now it's getting a little more practical. We want to get in a little more day-to-day. And how do I make that?
How do you actually do it?
How do I flesh that out? Yeah. So, you know, that every decision I make is, I'm actually making a decision whether you know, that we always hear that, right? If you choose, if you don't make a decision, you're choosing.
Well, I always talk about it like a vacuum. I mean, something's going to fill it.
Right.
The question is it what you wanted, or is it just what happened?
Right. And I think
that's the difference.
Yeah. One of the people we've been talking about lately with like finance, and we've both gotten into this guy, Dave Ramsey. He's just kind of, he's got some real practical knowledge and insight that I think he shares.
Fox Business.
Yeah.
Basically has a radio show, TV show, and pretty well known. But if you don't know him, you know, he's financial advisor.
Check him out. He's pretty good.
Yeah.
But one of the things he says over and over in creating a budget, and why we should create a budget, because who wants to create a budget?
So we're just talking about money now. We're not talking about health.
Yeah, so now we're talking about money. And you know, who wants to sit down and spend the time to make a budget? It's really, it's it really kind of, after a while, I've started to enjoy parts of it, but you know, at the end of the day, it's not really
fun. It's not
fun. What you're looking at, though, is the tagline he says is, you're telling your money where to go. And so you're actively making a decision. And so part of what he says is create... What was it?
A slush fund, but he calls it a blow fund.
I choose to blow this amount of money this month. And he says that's okay. You work that in on purpose because that's okay as long as I'm deciding to do that. And so I think we need to take a little bit of that approach with our health too and say, okay, all right, let's take a more active role in really saying, okay, why am I making this decision?
Tell your food what to do.
Yeah.
So your body,
Tell your food what to do.
Your body needs certain things to perform its functions, right?
Right.
So what you're talking about, making choices.
Yeah, so health isn't the only thing that plays into our decision-making process, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I have choice A or choice B of what to eat. I don't, you know, health isn't the only thing that's really playing the major role there. It's
and
like,
by health you mean?
By okay, I know this choice is healthier than this choice. So if I eat this fruit as opposed to eating this snack.
And that's a simple version of the decision.
Yeah.
Right.
It's like, well, I can make one or two, but you know, what's really playing into that? Well, if I'm thinking just health, I'm choosing the fruit. But if there's other factors involved there, you know, I really have to realistically look at that in a practical way.
Yeah, I was going to say, Joe, I mean, these discussions really bother me sometimes because life is just not practical. You know, you get busy, you don't always have time to shop. I mean, and then when you go to the grocery store, I mean, I just kind of get depressed and hunker down because it's like, how do you make a really good choice?
Right.
And I just feel like everyone's asking me to do perfection and I can't.
And we were talking about that too, you know, that the voices we're hearing that are trying to get us to go the other way,
mm-hmm.
trying to get us to eat healthier, are really screaming some more extreme things at us. And I think that can get us in kind of almost a kind of depressive state of like guilt.
It feels like all or nothing. I can't do all of it.
And
so,
if I'm not doing it and I'm not getting it right, then it's just guilt ridden, you know? So mm-hmm. I think we wanted to really explore some of the things that are kind of are just factors that we need to look at when we're making decisions. So we need on occasion food to be faster. We need on occasion food to be more convenient. We need it to be a better price. We need, you know, we need certain factors that are built in here that play a role, even if we don't actively think they play a role. They play a role in our day-to-day health.
So it comes down to really being conscious of what am I doing today, asking the question, how much food is in your food? And I think we're going to expand on that today, but even over a series of weeks. And then just like doing a budget, it stinks to have to make that active choice. But once you do that, once you make these upfront choices, before you need to, you can actually tell your food what to do. Tell it, well, I need this today from you, and that's what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
So you've actually outlined some important first steps, which is kind of a history.
Well, yeah, and I think we need to look at that. Food has changed in the last 100 years. I think we need to take a more active look at what we're eating because it's made such a huge change. And so it's not necessarily the food our grandparents or great-grandparents or, you know, great-great-grandparents ate.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about history, you know, 150 years, 200 years, not a really that big of a chunk of history. So, I mean, we've made some significant changes in the types of food we eat, how we eat these things, who's preparing the food for us, where are we getting the food from. You know, those things have really significantly changed in the last 150, 200 years, and even the last 50 years. So you're kind of looking over these things and saying, okay, what are the changes and how are they affecting me? How are they affecting me positively? We don't want to just, I think from our side too, it's not enough just to say, oh, all these things over here are bad and all these things over here are good.
Mm-hmm.
I think we, you know, day to day, we're all making decisions. I make bad decisions all the time.
It's much more dynamic than everything goes in a bucket, don't you
think?
Right.
Yeah, it really can't. You can't split a line because life doesn't work that way. It doesn't give you that option all the time. So I think we want to cut between what are we doing today and processing our food and growing our food.
Mm-hmm.
How does that affect us positively? What's the upside? And then also, what's the downside? I mean, every time we change something, there's always an up and downside, right?
There's some trade-offs.
Yeah, we want to be on both sides of this. We don't want to just look at this and say, oh, you know, it's all downside. You know, we all need to go back to farming our own food. We all need to have a cow on our property and, you know, chicken.
That's against my zoning in my neighborhood. But.
Yeah, right. Well, you laugh. I'm trying to convince my wife to do that. But at the end of the day, she's not really taking it.
Some of the Chicago so aren't conducive to chicken and cows. But there is an important fact is that we, you know, there was a time where we lived as a family on the family farm and we had access to grow our own food and that made sense. But even back then, there was some trade-offs being made. So it was never really perfect. They didn't have access to some of the things we did.
Right.
But Joe, are there some core things like is it variety? Is it that there's a makeup that's changed?
Right. Yeah. And so there's two main things I think we're going to explore. First is you know, modern farming. We've changed some things in the way we farm, and that has changed some things in the way that the actual food comes to us.
Mm-hmm.
We see that coming up more and more in studies, and in the ways we choose to grow can actually affect nutrient content, can affect toxicity, can affect even calorie makeup and some of those things.
Right.
And then food processing, once it comes out of the ground, once it's harvested, what do we do to it before it gets to us?
Right.
And that, once again, positive and negative effects there. So let's just go into some of the upside of what happens with some of the modern farming and some of the food processing we're doing today.
Okay.
So a lot of what we're focusing on, some of which we're hearing a lot more in the news with the peanut butter scare we just had last year, it was the meat.
Yeah.
You know, pathogenic bacteria and pathogenic microbes. We don't want pathogenic meaning disease causing.
Right.
We don't want things that are going to cause disease. You don't want E. coli. You don't want.
The popular ones that you hear.
Yeah.
So you're saying that may. How does that fit with food processing?
Yeah. So food processing. Part of the process is to actually create food so that it can last longer without being affected negatively by bacteria.
Right, which is the beginning of time. We've been trying to figure out how do we preserve food until we're ready to eat it.
Right.
And so those processes have changed.
Right.
And this has to be included in the modern process.
Yeah, and so the upside of modern day food processing is that we can have access to food that can be lower in bacteria over longer periods of time, so it can sit around longer.
So that's
and
a
not
positive.
Be, that's a positive. Yeah. It makes food available all year round, and actually it can make food available for years at a time. So
this includes produce too. Like, I'm amazed sometimes I go in the produce section, it's the middle of winter in Illinois here where we're at, and I can get almost anything. I mean, a few exceptions, but almost anything I want.
And if you look hard enough, I'm sure, like, if you're not finding it one place, you're going to find it somewhere else.
So whether it's in a box or produce, this all is really playing a role.
So, yeah, from a fruit and vegetable standpoint, that's a good point, is that, you know, we want to be eating more fruits and vegetables, and that makes them available to us all year round.
So that's another upside, number two.
Yeah. And so perishable foods, this kind of is in the last one, too. Perishable foods can be transported farther and stored longer. So that's kind of almost a summary of those first two there, is that we can have the upside of being able to transport food, you know, so we can actually send food to Africa and we can help feed some of the poor population that's there.
So it can be more widely distributed because it lasts longer and because it can sustain bacteria that doesn't acquire that.
Right.
So those are all upsides.
Yeah, and some of the ones that we're going to get into more specifically is that it actually makes food cheaper, makes food more convenient and faster, fast food. It also makes it more controllable, and that's some of the things we're talking about with the pathogenic bacteria and those kind of things. So that's some upside. I mean, it really is. I don't think anybody's going to fight us to say we don't want cheaper food or more convenient food or food that's more controllable. I don't think people are going to be like, well, we don't want that.
Yeah.
At the end of the day. I mean, there, you know, you always get extremists that will kind of fight things to the nth degree, but I think most of us can agree those are some positive things that can come out of food
processing. We're talking about on the whole. There are these things that we figured out how to do with food that do have benefits. And we have to acknowledge those. And that's what really disturbs me sometimes. We don't always talk about both sides. And I think what we're trying to do here is, you know, we're not, there's always this disclaimer in our podcast, we're not more of an expert than anyone else. In fact, less so in a lot of ways.
Right.
But we're at least here to say, let's just open up a dialogue And I think what we're emphasizing today, just to recap, is part of making active decisions is knowing what you're getting.
Right. Right. Upside and downside.
Okay. But both so sides. There could be a downside too, and we have to explore both sides.
Right.
There's two sides, same coin.
And just to be honest, we're going to be more skewed, obviously, towards, you know, what's the downside and like understanding the downside, because the downsides are really affecting our health
it's
negatively.
It's a critical component of prevention. Really.
Of health, yeah. Right. And so, you know, some of the downsides of food processing are you're going to have nutrient loss. You know, in most food processing, you're going to have nutrient loss through removal. Mm-hmm. So you know, when we process grains and we end up with refined flour, we take out the germ, which has most of the nutrients, the bran, which has most of the fiber.
And isn't part of that, too, just to speed up production? Like, we really want to grow fast, high yields, and
well,
get it to the...
a lot of it is, now it's becoming a texture issue. We just like that texture, but also a preservation issue. Mm-hmm. If the nutrients aren't there, it really makes it last on the shelf longer.
So it might not have all the nutrients we think it does. I mean, for example, we know wheat is good, but we have to think about, does it have all... This is the question we keep asking. How much food is in our food, right? That's a critical...
How much of the original food is still there.
Okay.
Yeah. And
so nutrient loss.
And then perceived variety as opposed to real variety. So we can actually process food. We can process, let's just keep with wheat, you know, into how many hundreds of different food types. So you have
a
pancakes
lot,
and croissants and couscous and you have bulgur and, you know, all these. You have a huge variety of things that come from one crop. And, I mean... I was reading one. I can't remember how many they said, but I mean, you can imagine them. You know, you can think of all the different varieties that are out there. Of what's made out of wheat. But it's really we're just eating the same thing,
mm-hmm.
as far as nutrient content, as far as some of the things that give health benefit. And you hear more and more: eat your colors, eat variety.
Yeah,
you know,
but
those kind of
so
things.
The acid test here is just look at your plate. And a lot of times, you know, so let's say for an appetizer before dinner, we have some crackers, right, with some dip or something, and then you know we have breads and pasta on our plate. Like literally, this could be a meal at our house, and then you walk away and you're like, oh, I didn't
some
really
kind of
eat
cake
any variety,
or,
but
some
I
kind of cake
I
or cookie at the end
for
and
dessert,
right?
Yeah,
and
so
it's all wheat, yeah, all wheat driven.
That's an interesting point. I never thought of it that way.
Yeah, and then through the process, we can also create toxins that come from the actual processing itself, from heat, or just the fact that it can sit around longer. The preservatives maybe we put into it. So there's a number of different things that can create actually in some way anti-nutrients, I guess you can call them.
But
maybe.
That sounds kind of scary. What is toxins exactly?
Yeah, so I mean, your life is affected daily by nutrients that give you benefit and then toxicity. And actually, your own body makes toxicity. It's not a new thing for your body to deal with.
That just means how much of something our body has too much? Or?
Yeah, so in your body's constantly processing. So the processing, if you overwhelm your body with toxicity, because it's creating its own and it's getting
so
it from externals.
So we talked about salt earlier in the news.
Right.
Like, that would be an example of having...
Right, yeah, I mean, to some extent. So the toxicity of salt really comes in more of a long-term kind of like heart disease type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's kind of a... it's not a black and white, but it's a good example to show that when you have 7,000 milligrams of sodium just injected into your body pretty much, then at that point it's going to physiologically change your body.
Two, or what's some other examples
so yeah,
the
so,
audience understands?
So I guess some of the ones that maybe let's go to what to some of them that have been kind of discontinued.
Okay.
Or DDT, you know, has neurological negative effects.
Yeah, but so DDT, but that's an example of it may be used at the farming level,
right?
That translates all the way. So if we're getting high exposures, or could mercury be another
example?
Right,
exactly. That's
so
a good example.
So you're eating a lot of fish,
right?
And then so there's even warnings like if you're pregnant, different things that you have to be very careful not
right.
get
Once
too
again,
much.
Neurological negative effects for your brain and brain development with mercury. Yeah. So these things are things that we come in contact on a regular basis. But the certain way you actually can process food can increase that, and it can actually decrease the amount of antioxidants.
Mm-hmm.
So those things that fight against toxicity in certain ways. That can help our body to process better the toxins that come in. We can remove those in food processing.
So continually asking how much food is in our food involves, well, how is it prepared? How is it farmed? So organic can be another example of you might not be exposed to those toxins.
Right, through the pesticide. Or,
yeah, as an example. But then also you highlighted variety and how that might, we might not be getting as much variety as what we need. And you actually had one last one, which is not so localized. That's sort of another downside.
Yeah,
right?
So we don't have as much connection to the farmer, which actually, once again, with these food scares, part of the issue there is I don't know where it's coming from. I just got sick, and I just ate a variety of food that came from different countries at this point.
And that's getting better, but that's still...
Well, and what I think is some of the downside is it increases regulation. And so I think it was last year. Now there's a regulation in California that you have to pasteurize almonds.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it may not sound like that big of a deal, and it sounds like a good health thing, right?
Right.
Well, in doing that, you destroy some nutrients and stuff like that. But the bigger issue here, I think, becomes if I'm a small farmer of almonds and I need to buy $500,000 worth of equipment to pasteurize now,
uh-huh.
I'm going out of business.
Yeah.
Or I have to become subject to this larger farmer of almonds who has the equipment. I have to send it there, though, and now there's another middleman. And so as a small farmer, I'm not really going to be as successful. So I think some of that becomes some of the downside. I know this is really looking more to the edges, but for me, the local and some of the things that can solve some of this, we'll play into it as well. But I think we're going to focus more on, day-to-day nutrient, day-to-day, the anti-toxin, like anti-nutrient kind of thing, how that affects my health, and what role does food processing and farming play?
Right. So, I mean, I think it's what we're coming down to is the fact that we haven't given you all the answers, right? You get to the downside, you're like, oh my goodness, there's all these.
We're like salt. We just make you thirstier.
But
we're like a high salty meal.
What we're doing every week, right? We're 7,000 milligrams of too much information. No, but what we're really getting down to is encouraging you to take a closer look. And,
right.
We don't have time to get into it today, but you talk about pasteurizing almonds and things like that. And then you almost have to say, well, is that good? Is that bad? What happens in that process? So again, we don't have all the answers. Bear with us as we go week by week. But hopefully we've given you four potential upsides of food processing, modern farming, and four potential downsides. So we try to, equally look at this and come away with some objectivity. But I guess, just in closing, is there anything that we can really take away from today's topic, just talking about how much food is really in our food?
Yeah, I think part of it is just heightened awareness of that daily decision. And, somebody else is really in control. My mother and grandmother are not necessarily cooking for me anymore.
Right.
It really is coming down to more of a Betty Crocker, Little Debbie, kind of a, it's a totally different game. Mm-hmm. And do these people care about my health? My mother did. And when she cooked for me and my grandmother, back in the day when it was a mother-grandmother, maybe combination, cooking for the whole family, there was a concern there for the health of the family. But where's the concern now? What is the focus now? I think we're going to spend the next three podcasts talking about that. What's the goal in making food now?
Right.
And so I think that what the source makes a big difference.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that will really play into a lot of what we're going to talk about in the coming podcast. But that's really where it comes down for me is looking at, we've given up control of our food to other people. What's their concern at the end? What's their bottom line? What's their concern? And how can I recapture maybe some of that and be more active in the decision-making process?
I think what's encouraging here, Joe, is you're highlighting for us that it was just a little information. For example, if we listen to the next two or three podcasts, we're going to see how decisions actually are very, very powerful. And we've highlighted research and all these things that sometimes just decisions over, did we get physical activity this week? What's on my plate and what portions are on my plate? What's the makeup?
Or why did I make the decision?
Why did I make the decision?
Did I need something faster today?
But calling people to go and get expensive gym memberships and all these things. We're not talking about overwhelming process that you have to do right from the onset. But right now, today, and for the next couple of weeks, we're just talking about making better decisions.
Yeah, and we're in process. I think that's what makes it so great. My wife and I are super practical people on every level, I think. When it comes down to it, we have three little girls, and so we have to make a lot of these decisions based on practicality. It just is. And life is, it needs that. And I think we're going to be able to offer you some balance in that and say, okay, I'm making a decision based on the practicality of this day.
And you can make decisions that will impact your life positively over the course of your life, and that's the important thing. So thanks for joining us today. Thanks for sharing today, Joe.
Thank you.
And that's our episode number 2, May 12, 2009. And remember, all the resources for the research and everything we mentioned in the show is available at www.oathealth.com/blog/podcast. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time.